Welcome back to the Logic Consortium. Today we have an interview with David Hyman, doctor, lawyer, professor at the University of Illinois College of Law, about his book Medicare Meets Mephistopheles. His recent book in satire form, which describes how Medicare contains the seven deadly sins and none of the two great virtues. So please stick around for the interview. Thank you. Thanks so much for the interview, Professor.
Happy to help out.
All right, great. Okay, as you know, your book, in a very interesting and innovative way, clearly lays out many of the problems with Medicare, which of course is the health insurance plan we have in the U.S. for people over the age of 65. In the book, you mentioned that there are a lot of problems with the quality of care that seniors receive. And I really wanted to start off talking about quality. And could you talk about some of the quality problems that there are?
Sure. Well, the starting point for our understanding what's going on is that Medicare pays a great deal of attention to the price for every unit of service that it purchases. But it basically allows individual physicians to decide whether or not a particular patient needs a particular service. And the result is that, you know, the volume is effectively uncontrolled. So the physician that you see can do a lot or can do a little. Maybe you need a lot, maybe you need a little, but the Medicare program really doesn't pay very much attention to that. And the result is, huge variation in the quality of care received by Medicare beneficiaries. If their physician practices, you know, cost-effectively and delivers high-quality care, well, then their patients get that. And if she doesn't, well, then they get something else, and the Medicare program pays for both. In fact, it can be more lucrative to provide low-quality care because you see the patient more. It's an encounter-based system. If you look more broadly at the way the program works, what you see is huge regional variation in the type of care that people receive. So there's a saying in the field, geography is destiny in terms of the care that you get. If you live in Miami, you get a very different level and intensity of services than if you live in Tampa or Boston or New York or Minnesota. And that results in huge differences in the costs to the Medicare program of the services that are provided, but the cost really doesn't correlate with quality. So spending more doesn't really buy you higher quality care. It buys you more services. It buys you more imaging studies. It buys you more visits to the doctor. But it doesn't really result in any impact, material impact on the outcome.
And you mentioned how really almost any doctor is allowed to be in the program. And this affects the quality as well.
Well, you know, this is a broader problem than just physicians. The basic approach of the Medicare program is if you can get over some relatively limited entry restrictions, you get a billing number, and then you can go off and more or less bill whatever you want. And this is part of the reason why the program has significant fraud problems, because there's just not much in the way of ongoing concurrent supervision of the decisions that are made by the people who are providing services. So if you get a bunch of Medicare billing numbers and you're a durable medical equipment supplier of, shall we say, questionable ethics, you can just send in a whole bunch of bills, collect the money, and then disappear.
And you mentioned in the book how the payment system of Medicare, fee-for-service, where Medicare reimburses the doctor a fee for whatever service they're doing, has created a bunch of incentives and that you kind of just reviewed as well. And one of them is the incentive to release quicker, to release the patient more quickly, because no matter what happens, they'll be reimbursed the same amount.
Well, what you're referring to is what's called the DRG system, which got implemented for hospitals in the early 1980s. And basically what happens is the hospital gets paid a flat amount based on the discharge diagnosis. And people, you know, were worried at the time that this would result in hospitals discharging patients, as they called it, quicker and sicker. And it's quite clear that hospital lengths of stay declined dramatically after the DRG system was implemented. You know, the question you need to ask is, well, how many of those people needed to be in the hospital and for how long? And those are, you know, complicated issues. There's going to be lots of variation among individual patients. But the thing that the DRG system did was it suddenly created incentives for the hospital to be more parsimonious in its use of services, because the way we used to do it was what was called cost-based reimbursement. The hospital would say, here's what it costs to take care of this patient, and the Medicare program would say, here's a check. And not surprisingly, that had huge inflationary consequences on our spending on Medicare, and it didn't do very much to provide high-quality care, right? It created an incentive to hospitalize people and to keep them in the hospital, but it didn't create an incentive to keep them healthy or to get them healthy in the first place. So what we sort of roll the tape forward now, you know, since the early 1980s, and what do you find? Well, hospital lengths of stay are much shorter. You have to be pretty sick to get admitted to a hospital. But the other thing that you see, and there's been some studies on this recently, is some hospitals discharge their patients and then they're okay. And other hospitals have a much higher rate of readmission. And the Medicare program pays for the initial hospitalization, and then it pays for the readmission. So what's the incentive effect? Well, you know, if you're a hospital, you don't have any particular reason to worry about avoiding readmission because you're compensated for that readmission. I'm oversimplifying a little bit. And this is a broader problem as well with what economists and lawyers would call agency costs between the provider and the patient. The provider gets paid for seeing the patient and for doing things to the patient, not for getting the patient healthy or keeping the patient healthy. In fact, making them healthier can be really good for the patient, but really bad for the provider economically, because if the patient's healthy, they won't come back to see the provider, and then you don't get paid.
You talk a lot about in the book the cost of Medicare and who's paying for it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different ways to understand the cost, right? The first is there are about 40 million Medicare beneficiaries, more or less. This last year, the program cost about $425 billion, B as in billion dollars. That's a lot of money. It's far, far more than the original projections of the program. And if you look at where that money comes from, the overwhelming majority of it comes from people who are not on Medicare, either from the contributions that are made by every working American. There's a specific tax on wages that Medicare imposes, about 3% on wages, which is shared between employer and employee. And then there's also fairly significant appropriations from general tax revenue, so that's paid by everybody who pays taxes. But the sort of striking thing is how little of the money comes out of the pockets of the Medicare beneficiaries. If you sort of look at the book that I wrote, there's a figure in there that sort of shows the overall sources of income, and 40% of it comes from those payroll taxes, 41% comes from general tax revenues. Beneficiary premiums are only about 11% across the entirety of the program. So that's, you know, it's a great deal for the people that are currently on the program, but the larger question is sort of our ability to sustain the program in anything like its current form. And I think, you know, pretty much across the political spectrum, people agree that there are huge problems with the financing of Medicare. There's less agreement on what we should do about it, but there's a huge amount of agreement that what we've promised people is going to be very difficult to deliver. So the $420 billion sounds like a big number, but if you ask instead, what's the amount that we've promised to people in terms of thinking, you know, all of the future beneficiaries of Medicare, the trustees of the Health and Human Services for the program have issued these periodic reports, and they use different measures of the sustainability of the program. So one measure, which I don't like very much, but it I think is easy for people to understand, is Part A, which is the hospitalization benefit. is funded by contributions from taxes on the wages of working Americans. And so what you do is you compare how much money is in that account versus what the outgoes are, and how soon do you expect to basically not have any more money left in that account. And you have to then start taking sort of increasingly dire steps to fund it, whether it's increased contributions from general tax revenues, which the Part A program doesn't currently get any of those, or increasing the tax rate for Medicare, or cutting fairly significantly amounts that are paid. And so what do people use? They use this figure of how many years is it until the trust fund is exhausted. And, you know, the program has never been on what I would call a sound actuarial footing, but right now the numbers are we're about 11 years out based on the sort of intermediate projections in 2019 or 2020. We're looking at exhaustion of the trust fund. It's never been higher than about 30 years. It's been as low as 4 years in the late 1990s. But, you know, the long and short of it, that's a somewhat worrisome indicator of what we would, you know, refer to as a trust fund. The other way of understanding it, which involves much bigger numbers, is to say, look, comparing what we've promised with what we expect to collect, what's the mismatch between, you know, our expected revenues for the program and our expected outgoes? And you get just staggeringly large numbers depending on whether you're using a sort of 75-year projection. And, of course, the longer out you make projections, the sort of less certain you ought to be about the specific numbers. But you're talking, you know, figures that are in the neighborhood of, depending upon which measure you use and so on, $85 trillion. That's the difference between what we've promised to pay and what we expect to have available to pay. And so you got to figure out a way to close that gap. And there are really only two ways to do it, right? One is to raise taxes, and the other is to cut benefits. And not surprisingly, neither of those are very popular. So, you know, to summarize, I think there's serious problems with the sustainability of the Medicare program in anything like its current form. There are going to be fairly dramatic changes in the program. The sort of question on which there's significant disagreement is what might those be?
In terms of the suggestions that you mentioned in the book, one of it from the side of the payouts by the government on the supply side, is something you suggest is that the government should be more than just a passive payer of claims. And there should be more money spent on claims review. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a very interesting issue. Okay, so a couple of observations, right? The first is the program was set up, in fact, to be a passive payer of bills. Its job was to process those bills and send out checks, or as I put it in the book, to shovel money out the door as quickly and as cheaply as possible. And it's done a great job of doing that. But the result is, if you actually want to buy high-quality health care, that's not a very good way of going about doing it, right? What you want to do is pay more to people who are doing a better job and try and figure out either how to keep the people who are doing a bad job out of the program entirely or pay them less in order to motivate them to do a better job. And, you know, one of the bragging points for proponents of the program is how low its overhead is. And, you know, we can discuss separately, if you'd like, whether the figures that they're using are actually reliable. But I think the broader point is the Medicare program dramatically underspends on administrative overhead. It ought to be doing a lot more to manage the quality of care rather than just being a passive bill payer. And that's part of the reason why we have these periodic scandals on Medicare paying out very sizable amounts of money for just out-and-out frauds, as well as paying lots of money for care that's just not as good as it ought to be. And this is not, just to be fair, this is not a problem that's unique to Medicare. We see quality deficiencies across the healthcare system. But the fee-for-service approach that's dominates in Medicare, it's about 85% of the program beneficiaries that are in a pure fee-for-service model, just creates huge incentives for, you know, volume without regard to quality.
Do you think that the fraud might be more prevalent in Medicare because the administrative expenditures are so low?
I think there are reasons for worrying about that. I think there isn't particularly good data on this. I spent a little time looking at that and wrote up my findings previously. It's very hard to get good data on fraud for a bunch of, I hope, obvious reasons now that you've finished up law school, Jacob. But the data there is indicates that there are problems in both the private and the public sector. There are reasons for thinking that the public sector may have worse problems because of the way in which it's structured its operations. But I just don't think there's good data on which to draw firm conclusions. The other issue is to keep in mind, what do we mean when we talk about fraud, right? There's a tendency to say fraud, waste, and abuse, or fraud, abuse, and waste. But those are different things, and you may want to think about them differently. For example, the Office of the Inspector General of HHS issues these periodic reports, and they talk about overpayments. Okay, that's one of the sort of sources of information people usually have for thinking about fraud, but the problem is not all overpayments are fraud. Some of them are problems with documentation, which if they were adequately documented, you'd say, oh, okay, this is acceptable behavior, this is actually high-quality health care. But we needed the written documentation to make sense of that. So I think the long and short of it is we don't know how serious the fraud problems are in the Medicare program, but there's, you know, a fair amount of anecdotal evidence that the number is material. Let's put it that way.
Another reform that you mentioned is from the demand side, from the side of the patient, that there should be more conservatism in terms of the patient. And this could be done with things such as healthcare savings accounts. With the savings accounts, instead of the government giving the money to the doctors, they put it in the patient's savings account, and then the patient can spend it at their discretion. Could you mention healthcare savings accounts and then demand-side conservatism more broadly?
I talk about demand-side conservatism. Health saving accounts, you know, have advantages and disadvantages. One of the things about health care is if it's free, there's a tendency to overconsume it, just like anything else. And so some sensible constraints for encouraging people to be cost-conscious consumers, given the nature of the agency relationship between physicians and patients, makes some sense. How much money you'll ultimately save as a result of that is a different question, right? The elderly consume lots of healthcare services. Some of those are, you know, perfectly appropriate, high-quality, value-added consumption of services, and some of them are just, you know, not wasteful. They're wasteful services. They're things that are not consistent with people's understanding of what's most appropriate. And the other factor to keep in mind is personal preferences vary as well, right? Some people want everything done. Some people are less enthusiastic about that. If you said to people, let me back up, how you frame the question makes a big difference, okay? So if you said to people, do you want everything done, that's one, you know, way to frame it, and you might get one distribution of answers. If you say to them, I'm going to give you $10,000, and you can decide whether you want to spend it on healthcare services or leave it to your grandkids, you might end up with a very different pattern of healthcare consumption. And how should we think about that, right? Should we say that the second case shows what people's actual preferences are when they're spending their own money? Because we've given it to them, right? It isn't that they're broke and so they can't afford healthcare. It's once they have the money, they just don't want to spend it on healthcare. And this is not a problem that's unique to healthcare, by the way. This is an issue with law as well, right? So it's quite common for the ABA to complain about access to legal services. And if you frame the question, do you have a problem that a lawyer can help with, you get one answer. If you say, if I gave you $500, would you spend it on a lawyer, you'd probably get a very different answer.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium in our interview with Doctor of Medicine, lawyer, and professor David Hyman, about Medicare in the context of his recent book, Medicare Meets Mephistopheles. Please stick around. Thank you. In terms of the reforms You mentioned that there are definitely political pressures out there that are resistant to change. I know you talked about that in terms of the physician lobby a little bit. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, again, it's not just physicians. So there are more than, you know, 1.5 million vendors of services to the Medicare program. And every dollar, effectively, of program expenditure is a dollar of income for them. And so, you know, any attempt to try and significantly constrain healthcare spending is going to result in a lot of pushback from people whose livelihoods is dependent on the Medicare program continuing to compensate them for the services that they provide. And so there's going to be significant political pressure not to do that. And Congress, you know, because hospitals are major employers, the healthcare sector is one of the few areas of the economy that's been growing fairly consistently and, you know, provides good jobs, there's going to be a lot of pushback. And so the problem is, in principle, everybody's keen on controlling the cost of healthcare. In practice, they can come up with all sorts of reasons why they shouldn't control it, and in some instances, why they should increase spending. So there's a constant fight between the rural states and the urban states as to why the Medicare program is spending more money in big cities than in local sort of rural areas. And, you know, you might, let me give you a very concrete example. So Minnesota is sort of, I think, a fairly common poster child for healthcare that's consistent, high quality, and you know, a reasonable cost, as opposed to healthcare delivered in some other parts of the country. Florida is the place that people typically pick on. So a couple of people up in Dartmouth have done a series of studies on regional variation, and they, you know, came to the conclusion that if we could get every senior citizen in Florida to get Minnesota-style health care, they'd be healthier, and we could buy each of them a top-of-the-line, fully loaded Lexus, and the program would still come out ahead after paying for their Minnesota-style health care and for their Lexus. So that's, you know, a pretty big variation in health care spending. But instead of, you know, trying to put the screws to the higher spending regions, the dynamic that you see is that the lower spending regions say, hey, how come we're not getting our fair share of Medicare spending? Which, you know, is, again, perfectly understandable, because a dollar of program spending is a dollar of income for them. But from the perspective of the taxpayers who have to foot the bill, it's not such a great outcome. And if what you care about is quality of care, it's not such a great outcome either, right? Higher spending doesn't really correlate very effectively with higher quality care.
Can you talk a little bit about the politics of the Medicare program?
Politics of the Medicare program are sort of layered on top of this as well, right? So this is part of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. It's one of the sort of big successes of a Democratic administration. It's part of their consistent goal to broaden the availability of coverage. And, you know, President Clinton tried to expand it. President Obama's going to try to expand it as well. Conversely, Republicans don't much like the Medicare program, right? It's a big, federal, fast-growing program. And so it really doesn't conform to their notions of what the federal government ought to be doing or what good policy is. So it's tied up with the larger politics, certainly, of the country.
And to finish up, as you just mentioned, the Obama administration is talking about health care a lot these days. And if they were to put forward a public plan where Medicare for people under the age of 65, where people could buy in, what's some advice that you would give to him on how to create a plan that would be of good quality, be able to serve people, the uninsured, and be cost efficient?
Well, that's a toughie, right? But as I tell my students, if this were easy, we'd have done it already. I mean, that's a broader point about health policy. So look, the first observation is what a public plan looks like profoundly affects what it does. So, you know, if your view is that the public plan is allowing people who aren't currently insured, or even some who are, but decide they prefer a public plan to opt into Medicare. That's a very different model than we're setting up a government program, a new government program, that doesn't rely on Medicare's purchasing power. And why does that matter? Well, it matters along a couple of dimensions, right? One is if you think that what you're trying to do is do a one-payer system, the purchasing power of Medicare is a huge advantage in accomplishing exactly that objective, because if you can purchase care for lower prices, you can offer lower premiums to individual consumers, and that's a huge disadvantage for your competitors. So if you're looking to, you know, move relatively quickly to a government-run program, that's one way to do it. I think there's a lot of pushback on that, some of it coming from insurance companies who don't want to see their market disappear, some of it coming from healthcare providers who have real concerns about having a 800-pound gorilla, that is the Medicare program, suddenly double its bulk by picking up another whole chunk of the market. And the broader point, you know, is one that antitrust lawyers talk about. This is essentially a buy-side monopoly. And if we think monopolies are bad in other settings, the question you have to ask is, why is it suddenly good here? If, sort of setting aside the purchasing power issues, I think the more fundamental point is there are real dysfunctions in the way the Medicare program is set up to purchase health care. And it would be unfortunate to replicate those in a new program, right? You ought to be purchasing high-quality care consistently. You ought to be creating incentives for people to deliver high-quality care in lots of ways. You know, it's a breach of faith to use government funding to buy low-quality care in exactly the same way that people get indignant if, you know, you buy military hardware that doesn't work, buying health care that doesn't actually, you know, serve its intended purpose ought to offend you for some of the same reasons. And so I think, you know, fairly significant restructuring is going to be necessary to make that happen. The difficulty is the Medicare's program and also other government programs, not all of them, but certainly the Medicaid program's basic approach has been we can get a low price and that's really all we need to do. And quality and volume will, to a greater or lesser extent, take care of itself. And the result, you know, is not particularly encouraging. You get people who are willing to take that low price not being all that thick upon the ground, and so there are access problems, bigger for Medicaid than for Medicare, but you're still starting to see them in Medicare now. And secondly, you know, again, if you control my price per unit, but you allow me to determine the number of units, you shouldn't be surprised that if one number goes down, the other number goes up.
Professor Hyman, yeah, I really appreciate the interview, and I'll send you a link when it's up.
Okay, well, great to talk to you, and good luck with your career.
And that was our interview with author David Hyman about his book, Medicare Meets Mephistopheles. Thanks so much for listening to the Logic Consortium. Please visit us at logicconsortium.blogspot.com. To make comments, you can even suggest a show. You can try to we can host a show. And thanks so much to Matt Hudson and Scientific Matt for this great song, Fear for Disappear. Have a great day.